Fazell joins us again this week on the Saturday Morning Show. And Jim, a week ago when we ended our conversation, you said there are some garden problems out there because of the weather. So let's pick it up and talk gardens this morning. What are some of the challenges gardeners like you are facing?
Well, there are some challenges, as a matter of fact. And, you know, the summer started out strangely, and it continues. It's either too wet or just too dry or it floods. We haven't had a lot of heat, just a few spurts of it, but it shows up in the garden. One of the things I've noticed is wilting in the garden. Now, it's very interesting because it doesn't matter whether a plant is too wet or too dry, it's going to wilt if it doesn't have oxygen around its roots or a little bit of moisture and it can't pick it up. So before you do any watering, you need to make sure that your plants are actually dry. Now, I've had some in my tomato row. I've got one end that's low, and I noticed that those plants were wilting about 3 or 4 days after a good rain. So I went out, and before I turned the hose on, I thought, I better do a little digging. So I did a little digging around there and found out the ground was absolutely saturated beneath that. So I cultivated it to get the air down to the roots, and they did perk up, and they're fine now. But that's a problem, especially this year where we've had flooding rains in some places where we get 2-3 inches of rain in just a short period of time, not to mention the areas where they get more than that and the ground is actually underwater for a period. If you can get the plants to dry out, they'll be okay. If you can't get them to dry out, they're just going to expire. So do make sure that they're dry before you water. Foliar diseases are a problem because it's been so wet. Even in the perennial garden, especially in the vegetable garden, but the perennial garden, a lot of the low-grower things like hosta and so forth have leaf spot, which we don't really see very often. The best thing you can do is to pick off the damaged leaves as soon as you notice them. There's always a question of fungicides. I'm hesitant to do that in the vegetable garden because fungicides are okay on some plants but not others. You have to read the label very carefully to make sure that it's safe on whatever you have. My inclination is you have so many tomato plants, only a few of them. It's not hard to go out and pick the leaves off or off the bean plants or whatever to get rid of that problem. Other problems with the tomatoes. A lot of people have just tons of tomatoes, all green, not ripening. We haven't had any warm temperatures. We don't have any 90-degree temperatures or have not had lately. Doesn't look like we're going to get much. Even high 80s would help. But these things ripen when the temperatures get up during the daytime and they're cool at night. Another problem with tomatoes, cracking. People that are picking tomatoes that do get ripened find out that they've got big cracks in them, and they wonder what caused that. Uneven watering. If the plants dry out while the tomato is developing and then re-moisten, the tomato itself picks up water and begins to enlarge in size, and it pops the skin on the outside of it. Now, if there's no rot or anything in those can be eaten. That's not a problem. You can peel them, slice the parts out that are cracked like that and use them. The other problem is squirrels. Squirrels seem to enjoy biting tomatoes. They don't eat them. They just bite them. And, of course, yeah. When they do that, that makes a hole in one side. If they ripen and you can get them out of the garden before any deterioration begins, just cut that part off and they're fine as far as you can, so you can use them. One of the things we like to do is, as those tomatoes get almost ripe, pick them, bring them in, ripen them indoors, because the squirrels seem to know the day that that thing is ready to be picked. Another problem with tomatoes and with peppers and squash is blossom end rot. Now, this is at the blossom end, which is the distal end of the fruit, turns black. It's kind of leathery. It's not rotted. This is a lack of calcium in the tissues of the fruit itself. That's due to uneven water again. It's not because there's no calcium in our soil. It's because the calcium didn't get to that fruit as it was developing. Normally, we see that on the first few plants, on the first few flowers and the first few fruit that come off of the plant. We don't see it after that. It doesn't hurt the thing. You can cut that blossom end rot off and use that fruit anyway. Poor pollination is another problem, and this can cause a lack of fruit on squash particularly, because you have to have the pollen moved from the male plant to the female plant, and either the bees are going to do it for you or you're going to have to do it yourself. So pollination can be a problem, particularly on squash. If you notice on squash plants, you'll have some flowers that have just a straight stem on them and some flowers that have just a little squash underneath the flower. Those are the females, and you've got to get the pollen from one to the other. We do have quite a few bees. In our perennial garden, we're seeing a lot of honeybees this year, which is really encouraging. And I noticed by the reports that the winter kill was not as bad as it has been in past years. Anyway, lots of things going on in the gardening. Some of us didn't get a good start on the garden. It kind of started as a washout for some of us, so we didn't get stuff planted. Some things didn't grow. It was, of course, too hot and too cold and too wet and so forth. But some spots are vacated now. Beans are gone. We've picked all of those, and it's time to do something for a fall garden. We have about 60 to 70 days before frost, so there are a lot of things that can be planted now and can grow and produce for you before we get a frost, and even after that, if you cover them, sometimes we have a frost for a night or two, and then it's fine, especially in October when we have Indian summer. But things like carrots and radishes and leaf lettuce, even chard and mustard can be put out. It does a lot better in the cool weather of fall than it does now. But you can also start indoors things that you started indoors for spring, like the broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower can be started right now, and lettuce and spinach, and you can put it out in the garden just as you did in spring. Incidentally, for those of us who like to grow garlic and use it for all kinds of cooking, now is the time to plant garlic for harvesting for next year. It's important that you get it in the ground now so that it will grow through the fall. It will sustain itself over the winter and will grow vigorously in spring and summer until it begins to die down. Then you can pick it. If you don't do it now, you're not going to get big bulbs underneath it. Out in the perennial garden, one of the things I like to do at this time of year is to evaluate the garden, and we've talked for years about notebooks, decide what changes you need to make, and then you need to label the plants that you're going to do something with. In fact, it might be a good idea to label the stuff that you aren't going to do anything with so you know where it is. Some things can be moved now, daylilies, Shasta daylilies, bulbs, spring flowers, and so forth. And incidentally, do you remember where your spring blooming wildflowers are? Probably too late this year to put a stake in there, a label in there, but you can do it next year. And once you get those things labeled, then you know what they are. So you need to do some planning to figure out where you want them to be. Also, in planning, sometimes it's harder to decide what you want to put where because you don't know how things are going to grow in your garden. One of the things that we have historically done is take one row, and we put the things that we're interested in that row just so we can watch them. Then by the end of a year or two, you know, okay, this plant's too big, this plant's too small, we don't like this color, this one falls over, or these are just fine. And the ones that are just fine, you can move into your garden, discard the other ones, and start another trial garden. So there's always stuff to do in the garden, and it's different every year. It makes it interesting, and that's what keeps us coming back every year. So we haven't talked about lawns. We'll do that in a couple of weeks when it's time to do something with them.
All right, let's do that. Is gardening still the number one hobby in the United States?
It is. Yeah. I don't have those statistics in front of me, but the vast majority of homes, somebody in the home does gardening, and it doesn't matter whether it is a house in the suburbs or a high-rise in the city with a gallery. In fact, we're downtown earlier this week walking down along the river and looking at all the beautiful balconies with the flowers hanging over the edges, and some of them even had things like tomato plants. So there's all kinds of stuff that can be done, and people find out how to do that. I know we're quite a ways from being an agricultural society, but there are a lot of folks that remember growing stuff, and they remember as kids growing stuff, and when they move to the city, they don't forget that. They're always looking for a place to put something that'll grow, and even on the galleries, the flower box works.
And let me tell you whose tomatoes are doing very well. Gloria on the patio behind our house getting a good crop. Now, she grows the smaller tomatoes, not the full-grown large ones, but, man, we're enjoying them.
Well, good. Ours are still sitting there. You know, it's a little cooler here where we are. We're closer to the lake.
Right.
We're waiting for some warm weather. But we have a few out there that are just getting almost to the point where they're going to begin turning pink. And as soon as that happens, I'm going to bring them in, and we'll put them in a warm place. And, boy, there's nothing like a bacon lettuce tomato sandwich. Wow.
Get them before the squirrels do. Jim, thank you so much for being with us again this week. Indeed, a good drive in the country to head to Goods Furniture at Kewaunee, Illinois. Last Saturday night, when we flew Air Orion down to Keokuk, Iowa, drove across the Mississippi into Illinois, and went to Hamilton, Illinois, the home of the Western Illinois Freshers Reunion. We flew right over the airport at Kewaunee, but we've been there several times to visit our good friends at Goods. Not only do they have good furniture, but they have some of the nicest people going. At 23 and a half minutes past 5 o'clock here on this Saturday morning, we're coming to the end of National Farmers Market Week, as proclaimed by Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue. And the popularity of farmers markets continues to grow. I hope you find time to get to a farmers market in your community. Enjoy the produce that's generally picked and harvested on the farm early on Saturday morning or whatever day of the farmers market, and then take into town where you have the opportunity to buy the freshest, but also to visit with farm people, the people who produce that nutritious food year after year, despite the weather challenge and everything else that we have to face. Illinois State Fair, of course, opened on Thursday with the ribbon-cutting ceremony, but something happened at the Illinois State Fair yesterday that I briefly want to mention. You know how I feel about 4-H and FFA, the two best leadership building organizations in the world as far as I'm concerned, because of the values that people learn in caring for livestock and producing crops and food on the farm. But something happened yesterday with Governor Rauner applauding a 4-H and Google.org collaboration. Now, this will support new computer science education programs in Illinois and throughout the nation. Google executives announced the partnership and granted a $1.5 million grant to 4-H at the Illinois State Fair yesterday in a special ceremony attended by Rich Giebert, the president of the Illinois Farm Bureau, and Jennifer Sarangelo, who is the president of the National 4-H Foundation that's based in Washington. But in his remarks yesterday, Governor Rauner praised the effort, believes it will bring computer science, computational thinking, collaboration, and problem-solving skills to the 6 million youth that 4-H serves in Illinois and around the country. So Google and 4-H trying to reach communities where children traditionally have limited access to computers, the internet, and computer science. And Jennifer said, working together, our two organizations will make a tremendous difference in the lives of young people by making computer science education accessible and engaging. She said, no matter where kids live or what they aspire to be, these are skills that will help them succeed. And I'm hoping that other companies beside Google will recognize this need in rural communities and join with 4-H and Google.com. Jennifer, who is president and CEO of the National 4-H Council, and for several years I was a member of that council and served with Jennifer and her leadership of the program. 28 minutes after 5 o'clock, we're in for a beautiful day, and it's Arlington Million Day at Arlington Park Racetrack. That's an agricultural industry in the state of Illinois and across the country. The thoroughbred business and the feeding and the care of the thoroughbred horses that perform at the racetracks. So we're going to be there as we are every year for the Arlington Million. Always fascinating to me how far those horses will travel to come to the Arlington Million. We have horses there from Argentina, from England, from Ireland, that are flown in to compete in the Arlington Million. So Come on out this afternoon. Post time for the first race is at 12:15, and 12 races on the card today. So a lot going on, and I guess I'd call it the Kentucky Derby of Illinois, or should I call the Kentucky Derby the Arlington Million of Kentucky? Not sure which one is the proper designation. County fairs, yeah, there are county fairs that are going this weekend as we move quickly along through the county fair season. And the county fairs that are underway this week, let me quickly take a look at them. The county fairs that will be ending tomorrow because they end on Sunday. And so we have the Kankakee County Fair at Kankakee and the Boone County Fair at Belvedere winding up tomorrow. But then next week, another good lineup of fairs, Winnebago County Fair at Pecatonica, the Will County Fair at Piatone, and they're within easy driving distance of the Chicago area, so go on out and enjoy a county fair. The start of a very nice summer day in August, so we hope you'll take time to enjoy the outdoors and the many activities we've been talking about, county fairs and state fairs. Oh, I do have advice, by the way, on how to eat the famous cream puff at the Wisconsin State Fair without getting it spread all over the front of your shirt or your blouse or whatever. The world famous cream puff at the Wisconsin State Fair is like a hamburger. It is served on a pastry bun, and if you just bite into the bun, you can get that cream all over the front of you. But here's the way to eat a cream puff at the Illinois State Fair. Just kind of give a twist to the top bun and separate it, and that will leave cream on the bottom bun and on the upper bun, and it won't end up on your shirt or your blouse. So that's my advice on eating the cream puff at the Wisconsin State Fair. Time to say welcome to Samuelson Says, sponsored by Wink Products Company. They're the makers of quality specialty cleaning products. They've been doing it since 1947. This week, talking about losing the Rhinestone Cowboy. But I'm delighted to have been on the air for Wink Products Company for many decades now. Wink Products Company is one of those Midwest success stories, a family-owned corporation in rural Eldora, Iowa. And it has manufactured specialty cleaning products for, well, since 1947. And today, Wink, from that small town in Iowa, is a nationally recognized brand because Wink products work. I've been telling you that for years. Wink manufactures professional strength household cleaners and drain openers for you. So learn about all of the Wink products at wink.com. That's WHINK.com. The passing a few days ago of Glenn Campbell, the Rhinestone Cowboy, brought back a very vivid memory to me, and I'd like to share it with you this weekend on Samuelson Says. Go with me back to the early 1970s. Richard Nixon was president of the United States, and Dr. Norman Borlaug, the Iowa farm boy, had just been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for the Green Revolution that he developed for the world in the 1960s. And, of course, he did that because he came up with new wheat varieties, new rice varieties that would do well in the developing countries in the tropics, and he helped save a lot of people from starvation. As a matter of fact, Norman's book is entitled The Man Who Saved a Billion Lives, and I believe that. So President Nixon decided to salute Dr. Borlaug and American agriculture by hosting a dinner at the White House, inviting 160 guests. I was fortunate to be one of those guests, and at the table of eight that I shared were Senator Bob Dole of Kansas and Glenn Campbell. During the evening dinner conversation, Glenn and I discovered that we did have a lot of similarities. So he said, look, when the dinner is over and you have finished what you have to do, come over to the Hay Adams Hotel and give me a call. Come to my room and we can visit even more. Well, I did that. And for 2 hours in that hotel room at the Hay Adams, we shared a lot of stories and similarities, except one. He came from a family of 12 in Arkansas, and I came from a family of 2 in Wisconsin. But we both grew up in farm homes without indoor plumbing, without electricity. And this was Glenn's way of describing it. I spent the early parts of my life looking at the north end of a southbound mule, and it didn't take long to figure out that a guitar was a lot lighter than a plow handle. Well, I learned the same thing about my profession. Getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to milk cows every day of my teenage life, I thought, there's got to be another way to do this. And I discovered that milking cows was a lot tougher than just talking about it, and so I became a farm broadcaster. But it certainly brought back a lot of very pleasant memories, and, of course, the great music that came from Glenn Campbell, the rhinestone cowboy. I'll certainly miss him. My thoughts on Samuelson Says.
From Allendale Incorporated, Paul Georgie joining us in the studio with the August crop report behind us now. The numbers, the surprising numbers that came out in that report, yields were bigger than expected, right, on both corn and soybeans?
USDA had a big surprise on corn yields at 169.5. The trade average was looking for about a 166 yield, and I think in reality they're thinking it's a 163.5 yield. So that was a big surprise to the trade, putting the ending stocks basically the same as they are this year. Many were thinking that we could have ending stocks in below 2 billion bushel. They're still looking at 2.3 billion bushel, so not much change there. Soybeans, same kind of situation. Actually, a bigger surprise there. They raised the soybean yield to 49.5, which is about a bushel and a half more than what they had in July, and about 2 bushel more than what the trade was expecting. But the reason they came up with these big yields, Max, is that they showed tremendous crops across the Delta, the Southeast, and even up into New York is where they had record corn yields, record soybean yields they're projecting in those areas. So that's offsetting some of this problem that we have here in the Midwest.
The yield number on soybeans, as I look back through the years, there was a time when USDA played it very conservative in the August crop report. And I think if you look back over the past 20 years, a significant number of those, more than half, wound up with a final higher soybean yield than that August estimate. They're not conservative in this number, are they?
They're not conservative, but, you know, they're not conservative overall as far as the overall average, because they're putting a lot of bushels in the Delta and in the South. I think the surprise comes here in the August report. Everybody thinks that the USDA is going to make big adjustments on yield potential acreage. They don't normally do that. Out of the last 15 years, I think they've only made adjustments 5 times that were significant on the yield. They wait until the September, the October numbers before they really cut the crop dramatically. Like the crop in Indiana, for instance, they held it the same as a year ago. And talking to producers in Indiana, especially around Kokomo, they're saying, I replanted 4 times, and there's no way I'm going to get the corn that I had a year ago. So they leave a lot of room for adjusting down the road. I don't think you take this to heart completely, but the problem is it's not friendly to help us get some of this old crop corn sold that we got holding in the bins right now.
acreage. And you talked about the fact that farmers replanted. Some did not get planted. Have they fully taken into account in this report, in your mind, what has happened with the acreage, the unplanned development of acreage because of a wet spring?
Well, I think they did to acreage what we expected they would do, and that's not change anything. Because out of the last, since 1980, they've only changed seven times on this report, and it was very small amounts. So they normally don't change the acreage. That's coming yet. We will have the FSA report looking at prevent planted acres there. I think the key number on this FSA report is the prevent planted, because history tells us that whatever they come out with in the August prevent planted number is about 94 to 99% of actual acres. So they don't change it very much. So that will be extremely important on the prevent planting. So then we'll start to get some acreage numbers that we play with here, and what we will expect. Everything in this August report from the trade was really a guess and what they see. So I think we've got that coming down the road, and that could be a bit friendly, I would think.
A farmer who was looking for the opportunity to market and still some of that old crop corn sitting around didn't get the chance to move it on out with this report, did they?
This is not good for the guy that's holding on to the old crop grain expecting a rally. However, there is a bright spot here, and that is the more research has done a look at what the price of corn does after the August report. 13 out of the last 15 years, the next 2 weeks, the corn market rallies. So hopefully we can see that. And I could understand why we could see a rally here even after we have this bearish number. It's simply because of the FSA number that comes out. And when we get out in the field and start to see the yield, that could change dramatically.
And weather is still important, is it not, for some of the late planted crops?
Weather is extremely important. I mean, the development yet, rain in August makes the bean crop, and there's a lot of areas that August is moving right along here, and we need to get some rain, and especially in Iowa, in a big soybean-producing state. The other thing that we haven't talked about yet but will come up in the next few weeks is this early frost. When are we going to freeze? We got a lot of corn. Even in our area here in northern Illinois, we got corn just tasseling this week, and it's got a long way to go before it develops a ear that can be harvested.
So stay close to your advisor. People like Allendale, I would imagine you'd say, right, Paul?
I would say stay close to us, and check in with us on our crop survey. That's coming up here in about 10 days.
Paul Georgie with Allendale Incorporated.
And after the report on crop conditions on Thursday, USDA later did come through with those acreage numbers in prevented plantings, acres that couldn't be planted because of weather conditions or whatever. And 950 million acres of corn in the prevented plantings number, 437 million acres of soybeans, and 614 million acres of wheat that didn't get planted because of weather conditions. And our thanks to Paul for joining us, but he wasn't the only person who joined us in our studios this week. There was
Don Torte with Farm Progress. What's happening the end of the month?
It's the biggest farm show in America comes once again to Decatur, Illinois. And, a little over 2 weeks away. It's amazing how quickly that time flies.
But you spend an entire year preparing for this show.
Certainly our team does. It takes a lot of moving parts, a lot of people, and, not only us, but, our exhibitors as well. It seems like they get through one or two of their winter shows, and they're already preparing for the Farm Progress show.
So what's happening to the number of visitors to the show? Stable?
Well, that we'll see when we get there, but we would anticipate, we look at advanced ticket sales right now. They're up versus where they've been in the past, and we're prepared for a great show.
Oh, and the question is, you can order tickets online. Where do you go?
FarmProgressShow.com. So if you go there, there's the opportunity right on there to not only order tickets in advance, but also get a discount for doing so.
And you can map your show. I mean, you can go and decide what you want to do, and you can actually work with the website to determine your route at the show.
Not only see what exhibitors are there, but mark which ones you'd like to see, and then that kicks out a schedule look, so it can help you plan your day at the show. There's a lot to see and do, so it's probably a good thing to do.
Growers are definitely serious about what they want to see, but it does become somewhat of a social event for some, too. I have a friend who goes in his camper, and he's 8 a.m. with the gates open. He knows what he wants to see, but I'll get a text from him the night before. He'll say, "We're in town, Max. Come see us." And it's really a neat event, the way growers plan their end of the summer around it.
Right. Well, you know, we're not shy about that. The right farmers are there. Exhibitors know that. But it's also, it's a social event. It's an opportunity for agriculture to come together and see the latest in agriculture, but also bring everyone together. And that's a big part of the world that we're all in.
The permanent structures that are going in on your two sites, it seems like they're increasing. Case IH has put in one for this year.
Yeah, they have. And that's really nice because it's easier for them to set up. But it's also, like we say, with permanent restrooms and permanent streets, it's great for the visitor. It's great for a visitor for in a case exhibit as well, because you have a cement floor, and it just makes it a little bit more weather independent.
More of the buildings have air conditioning, too.
The last couple years, we've counted over 30 exhibits with air conditioning, which is amazing. It wasn't that many years ago, none had it, and now it just continued to expand.
Of course, the hallmark of this show over the years, and I don't think you were at the first one, Orient, in 1953.
Not quite, but not too many years thereafter.
It's the field demos, of course, that were the hallmark to begin with, and you still emphasize field demonstrations.
Absolutely. It's one of the special things. It's kind of the magic of the Farm Progress Show. So we'll have combining. The crops look great. We got them in early. It was great planting weather. It's been kind of a tough growing year, but they look right on schedule for harvest. So we'll have harvest demonstrations. Right before harvest demonstrations, we're having drone demos. Later that afternoon, we have field tillage demonstrations. And then there's tiling demonstrations and ride and drives as well. So lots of moving parts that people can actually see machines work.
Drone demonstrations. I would imagine that not only emphasizes the aircraft, but probably the software now.
Yeah. A lot of that right before combining will actually be the aircraft that they'll be doing. Dennis Bowman from the University of Illinois will be utilizing that. It's hard to do because we're so close to an airport right there, but he has the FAA license to do that. So we need to make sure that's all under his control, but it should be a really neat part of the show.
One thing about these permanent sites, and especially Decatur, Illinois, being close to the interstate, you don't have the vehicular traffic nightmares that you once did going out to a remote farmstead.
Right. We're always a little bit of backup is not always bad because a lot of people are coming in, but you're not going to be in line forever. You know, it's right at the interstate, plus, you know, the state police and local law enforcement, they're really good at that. They've been doing it enough.
We sure look forward to seeing you there, Don. Thank you for coming in to give us a little bit of a preview. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. We look forward to seeing you there.
Don Torte with Farm Progress. The Farm Progress Show coming up the 29th through the 31st, Decatur, Illinois. Yeah, we'll be there. We'll be at ADM each day during the noon hour. We hope you'll come see us.
Indeed, we hope you will come see us, because Max will be appearing at other the exhibits as well, Case IH being one of them. And every day at 10 o'clock, I will be at the University of Illinois tent, and we'll be talking to market specialists and other people who are on staff at the University of Illinois. And come see us at the Farm Progress Show. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, August 29, 30, and 31. But ahead of that comes the Half Century of Progress Show at Rantoul, Illinois, on the old air base there. And Max and I will be there, of course, and we'll be doing a show with the Back Page. That's our band Saturday, 2 weeks from today, starting at about 3 o'clock. So come see us there, and then come see us at the Sandwich Fair. Max will be there on September 6th. I will be there on September 7th. And then on Saturday, September 9th, I'll be at the Salute to Agriculture Day at the University of Illinois and the football game. So a lot going on the rest of this month, but we'll get it done and look forward to seeing you. Every year, despite what I tell you, I get emails saying, "What are the dates of the Sandwich Fair in Sandwich, Illinois?" And I give you the same answer. It always starts the Wednesday after Labor Day. So that means the 6th of September, Max Armstrong will be there, and the 7th of September, I'll be there, and it goes through Sunday of that week, but always starts the Wednesday after Labor Day.